Hey, Dana.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good. We should introduce ourselves. Yes. I'm Emily Bazelon. I'm a senior editor at Slate.
And I'm Dana Goldstein. I'm an associate editor and writer at the Daily Beast.
Excellent. And we thought we would talk today about some new books on marriage that we feel like are flooding our shelves, in particular
yes.
Lori Gottlieb's title.
Yes.
And then we'll talk about some political marriages, too.
Definitely. We're being totally buried under marriage books here at the Daily Beast. We have this one. I'm showing them. And we have this one. And here's Lori's book, which we're going to discuss now, Marry Him, Settling for Mr. Good Enough. So do you want to talk a little bit about the great piece you ran on Slate by Jessica Gross?
Yes. Well, Jess's point in this piece was that the concern that Lori Gottlieb has, so we should back up a little bit. Lori's book is about settling. It's about this question of if you don't find the right man to marry in your late 20s or early 30s, and you're someone who wants to get married, and you want to have children, do you find someone who's kind of good enough? Do you let go of your more romantic notions about finding a life soulmate and just find someone who kind of you can check the boxes off for? Someone
right.
who will, you know, make some amount of, some decent sum of money and not prove to be an axe murderer.
right, and most controversially, she says that feminism was actually she blames feminism for the reason why she's a single mom and she's not married. She basically says feminism ruined my life, essentially.
Right, and her thesis, I think, is that the problem with feminism for her is that it made her incredibly demanding and increased her expectations, made her expectations outsized and unrealistic about what marriage should be and what you can really expect from your spouse. Right.
Exactly.
Right. And Jess's point in this piece that she wrote for Slate was that Gottlieb's concern is misplaced if you talk about it in terms of the population, that she sort of acts as if she's writing about every woman, but instead it's clearly a book for upper middle class women, and that in fact this is a really good time for well-off women in terms of marriage, and that the real issue is working class women and the problems they're having finding good men to marry.
Right, and Jess actually had some great stats. She said that 80% of female college grads are married, and it is the best time ever in American history. And the increase in single women and the increase in the divorce rate have been increasingly among low-income and working-class women without a college degree. But it seems like culturally we're really concerned about the people that are in the class of women who write books, which are college-educated women. Do you have any theories as to why?
Well, I think there's this really... This comes up all the time in writing about marriage, in writing about children, parenting. It's sort of a constant for me, and I think about it in my own work, what I'm talking about is the tension between making a point that resonates broadly and kind of making the claim that your experience or the experience of a small group of women you know has some larger significance, and then the reality, which is that often you're writing for a very thin stratum of society. I mean, not that other people might not read you, but that in fact the very particular concerns you're describing apply to a much smaller group. This comes up for me a lot when I'm reading Caitlin Flanagan's stuff in The Atlantic, that actually she is a very wealthy person, and you can see that if in her pieces, and yet we all kind of use the mantra of the middle class, this term. Everybody in America wants to be in the middle class. Well, in fact, a lot of American writers are not in the middle class. They're not, you know, they're not in the kind of $50,000 or $70,000 a year income bracket for their entire family. And as a result, I think we kind of get lost sometimes. We don't really want to identify how particular what we're saying is, because then it would seem like snobby or elitist. But then on the other hand, you end up making a claim that can't really be generalized broadly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I also wonder, and I've thought about this a lot myself, if the recession and sort of our economic anxiety right now has something to do with the kind of onslaught of thinking about marriage. I mean, it is true that when you're pressed for money, you might be a little bit more dependent on your spouse's income, and there's some evidence that the divorce rate is going down, and it might be because people just can't afford to be a single parent right now. You know, and something I think right. about in my life, you know, my boyfriend and I live together, and I worry that if one of us were out of a job, we couldn't pay our rent anymore. So, and, you know, we're not poor, we're middle class. So I think there is a cultural moment right now that people are sort of hungering for the security that marriage brings.
Right, I agree. And so maybe that's why the idea that marriage is hard to come by is having this cultural purchase, even if that's really true for working class women as opposed to for more upper middle class women.
Yeah, and it's always been sort of a conservative belief, and not just conservatives, but I think people across the political spectrum sort of feel that marriage can solve a lot of social problems. And while there's lots of evidence that, especially for young boys, having an active father is so important, I think sometimes we take it a little bit too far. I mean, if you look at what the Bush administration did, they spent something like nearly $1 billion total on their Healthy Marriage Initiative, which was about encouraging people on welfare to stay married, not to separate, to marry their partners. And it's sort of interesting that the Bush administration, which wasn't interested in providing that class with social services, which wasn't interested in universal daycare or universal health care for the kids of poor people, would be so sort of attracted to that marriage idea, sort of ignoring whether the working class men were going to be good husbands, were going to be good dads. In those particular relationships, the idea that marriage is so, it's kind of a cure-all for our social problems, when actually I think for women like ourselves, for educated middle-class or upper-middle-class women, as well as for poor women, if we had universal high-quality daycare, then the lives of working moms and single moms would be so much easier. But instead, we're kind of just worrying about relationships and telling women to settle, and it seems like to me there's more systemic problems.
Right, although I'm not sure, I sort of feel like, I'm sure you didn't mean to say this, but one of the conclusions from what you just said is the notion that you can, who needs a husband as long as you have a good daycare center?
No, I don't think that's true, certainly not, and I'm, you know, grateful for what I consider a healthy relationship myself, and I do think that what Lori Gottlieb writes, which is true, is it's lonely to be single, and it's yes. wonderful to have a partner, and I especially because it's Valentine's Day coming up, I certainly wouldn't want to negate the feelings or struggles of people who are single, and that's something that they hope for. And I do think that, you know, something that I think feminists should embrace are healthy relationships, and that it is completely legitimate for women to want a partner in their lives, whether it's a man or a woman, whatever your sexuality. I don't think that women need men like fish need bicycles.
Right, but I also don't think feminists really, most feminists ever really said that women should get away
no.
from men. I mean, that's, you know, the most extreme parody version of 1970s feminism getting pilloried once again, as it so often does, because it's kind of a useful stalking horse. But I just don't believe that it ever had enough social or cultural power to quite warrant all of the attacking we like to do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if I think about the young women I know who are feminists, I think most of them are in really healthy relationships. And when I think about relationships I've had in the past that have worked or haven't worked, I often think that sort of the more feminist your partner is, you know, that's a great starting point for a healthier relationship.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's interesting. I mean, I also think that, to me, the idea of blaming this larger force of feminism for one's own personal failures in relationships seems sort of questionable, because there's so many complicated psychological forces that go into whether these relationships work or not. I mean, I have to say that it's hard now to think about Lori Gottlieb's book without thinking of the response on Jezebel from a guy who she identifies as Tim, who, you know, this is hard because we can't fact check what his response to her, but he really had kind of the sweetest sort of revenge in this interview, this great interview he did with Jezebel, in which he basically says that, you know, she was incredibly demanding and cruel to him about his weight, and someone who herself was maybe not ready for what you would call a healthy relationship. And it just is a reminder, whatever the truth of the matter is, which I don't think we'll ever really know, it's a reminder that this is really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. And you guys wrote on your XXX blog that it's an argument to not write a memoir, which I think is a perfect segue to the next book that we were going to talk about, which is Jenny Sanford's book, Staying True, because your colleague Hannah Rosen had written some really smart stuff about what goes into writing such a revealing memoir about one's marriage.
Right. And one of the points Hannah makes is that Jenny Sanford has put her... Now, Jenny Sanford, of course, is the wife of Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina, who will be forever remembered for having put out there the idea that he was hiking on the Appalachian Trail when he was really going off with a woman he was in love with in Argentina. And so the question, of course, is why did Jenny Sanford write this book right now, other than the obvious answer, to make money? And what she says very earnestly throughout the book is that she wrote it to mollify her boys, that she has these four children and they needed to understand what had happened. And Hannah begins her piece, and I couldn't agree more, by saying that it's really impossible to imagine that this is a true justification for this book, because children do not need to have their parents' dirty laundry aired in the middle of a really sad separation and divorce.
Yeah, absolutely. And Megan McCain is a contributor here at The Beast, and sort of looking at Jenny's book and some other stuff that has gone on in politics lately, she actually wrote a piece for us saying that politicians and politicians' families need to kind of tamp down on the personal disclosures.
Uh-huh.
That it's not the best thing for their children. And she's someone who has personal experience with that, and I think that's what Hannah was getting at. You know, as a child of divorced parents, I do think that there's something to be said for not knowing everything that's gone wrong in your parents' relationship. And even if your parents are happy and stay together, there should be a little mystery there, I think.
Right. I mean, I also, one other question I had in reading the Sanford book is, you know, Jenny Sanford is a religious woman. She talks a lot about the Bible, and she talks about forgiveness and her quest to forgive her husband, and yet there is just something inherently unforgiving about her portrayal of him. And I'm not saying she's wrong. It's just not my idea of forgiveness. I mean, she tells she has a great eye for detail. You know, here he is giving her a Christmas card with a picture of half a bike, and then the other half of the bike shows up on her birthday, and in fact it was a $25 used bike. You know, he gives her this beautiful piece of diamond jewelry, and then when he sees it on her says, no, take it back, that wasn't worth it. I mean, there just are these many occasions in which he is clearly failing the Valentine's Day test, but really failing the decent. And then I think the worst part is that once his affair is revealed, he's constantly calling his wife not to talk to her about her feelings, but, you know, so he can get her political read on how he's performing. And then
I know, that seemed like just one of the cruelest parts of it to me.
That's really true. And then, you know, he also dares to basically beg her to let him see this woman again, even though supposedly they are in the process of repairing their marriage. It's really over the top.
It is. You know, it's interesting, when Jenny first announced that she was leaving Mark Sanford, people were really celebrating her as an icon. I wouldn't call her a feminist icon, but I guess a icon of female strength, because here she was with this high-profile husband, and she wasn't going to stand by him, she was going to leave him. And since that happened, Elizabeth Edwards also says that she's pursuing divorce with her husband, and I'm sort of wondering if this is kind of a cultural moment where we're going to be seeing more high-profile political spouses leave their husbands after these sorts of affairs.
Yeah, it's hard to say whether that's what's happening, and you know, from a feminist point of view, I think I would applaud that, or whether this is just a sample of two, and in fact, most women will kind of behave more like Zilda Spitzer, who stood by Elliot Spitzer, and you know, I think for all these women, it just must be such an exquisite dilemma. On the one hand, they have devoted their lives to this man in terms of their marriages, but also in terms of the careers they've given up and the families that they've created. And on the other hand, you know, there's this real harm and incredible hypocrisy that turns out to be kind of, you know, corroding the entire thing. It's a terrible choice. I really don't envy them, obviously.
No, definitely. And I think until we sort of see it happen with the president and the president's spouse, it would be hard to judge if expectations have changed, because I still can't see a sitting first lady leaving her husband. I mean, that's sort of out of my range of imagination. I mean, I don't think that if Bill and Hillary were in the White House now as opposed to during the 90s, that it would have been considered acceptable for her to leave. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I really hope that we don't get to find out about the president. I just don't.
I know, yeah.
That sounds like no
fun.
A lot
of hearts would be breaking if there was any trouble of that sort in the Obama marriage.
Yeah, or just any. I just don't want that drama. Oh, I hated that in the Clinton administration. It's so distracting. I just don't think it's good for the country. The country has more than enough real problems to worry about.
Yeah, I think that I was, you know, in junior high during the Monica Lewinsky stuff, and it was an incredibly sort of formative political moment for me.
Right, but not necessarily one we all need to relive.
No, no, definitely not. And then I guess just to be gossipy before we end, the latest gossip about John Edwards is that he asked Rielle Hunter to marry him, which is not confirmed. It was reported by The Enquirer and then republished in the New York Post. But I guess, I don't know, my one thought on that is, like, who else would be with this guy at this point? I think he seems more despicable than pretty much any other cheating spouse in the public eye. I don't know about Tiger Woods, but...
Yeah, there's really, like, a little parade of them. I don't think I want to choose my my worst defender. But I don't know what to say about this gossip other than that my heart is with Elizabeth Edwards. I just, like, I don't... Yeah, maybe John Edwards and Rielle Hunter deserve each other.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she seems worshipful of him, or at least she was back then. It's hard for me to believe that after everything that's happened, though, she would take him back. But then again, we don't know very much about her.
Right, right. So I think we should check in next Valentine's Day and figure out how this soap opera has unfolded.
I guess it's a stay tuned sort of thing. So are you a Valentine's Day cynic or a supporter, cautious supporter?
I am, you know, I'm so bad about holidays in general. And any holiday that I don't have to pay attention to because of my children, I just mostly feel relieved about not being obligated to perform in some way. So no, I would guess one of my sisters is born on Valentine's Day.
Oh.
So for that reason, I have a very sweet association. But that's kind
of it. Did she come home in a heart-shaped basket? Because I know someone who was also born on Valentine's Day and was brought home in a heart-shaped basket.
That is so lovely. No, but my dad gave my mom a very pretty heart-shaped necklace.
Oh, that's sweet.
How about you? What's your Valentine's Day take?
I don't know. I told my boyfriend that it would be cool to get flowers, but I'm not really expecting to do very much. I hate going out to eat on Valentine's Day. I hate how it's like the heart-shaped raviolis, and you're sort of, it's like, it reminds me of that scene in Sex and the City where Carrie and Miranda go out with each other on Valentine's Day, and it's just the most disgusting scene in the restaurant.
Right, I remember.
I just don't want to relive that, and I just think everyone should stay home on Valentine's Day.
And watch that episode of Sex and the City.
Yes, perhaps.
All right. It was a total pleasure talking to you, Dana. Thank you.
You too, Emily. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.